Good afternoon. Good afternoon. And welcome to week 29. Week 2 of this year, because you got such a late start with it. But week 29 of Ezra and Nehemiah. Last week, we did our basic review. Took ourselves through the first 9-plus chapters. This week is a controversy week. All right, we're gonna have problems this week. Matrilineal descent, which we talked about a little bit at the end of last year, but now we need to figure out what in the world is going on. So again, we're at the beginning of chapter 10. If you're using the Stone Tanakh, it's page 1835. 1835. Ezra Parakud, still chapter 10. That's fine. Remember that in chapter 9, Ezra found out that the Jews have married non-Jewish women. We had the minority view that this is referring to what happened in Babel, in Babylon, and then what seems to be the straightforward view from the text, and supported by various commentators, that no, what we're talking about is the people who Ezra handpicked, the people whose lineage he worked on, the people he brought with him in his own group just 4 months earlier, have been marrying among the various tribes of the area. Ezra is very upset. He fasts, he tears his hair, performs all sorts of demonstrations of grief, sits on the floor, and the people themselves, led by a fellow by the name of Shechaniah ben Yechiel, say that they are going to do something about it. They are going to separate from the non-Jewish spouses. The last thing that we had done last year was the lack of a conversion option. Why doesn't anybody talk about conversion? That's a separate point. We're not going to come back to that now. But yeah, go for it, Susan.
When you said, is it from Ezra that we sit on lower chairs?
What do you mean? You mean in terms of that as a practice of mourning?
Yes.
No, that precedes Ezra. That precedes Ezra. But what Ezra is doing does reflect acts of mourning. What I think his actions may be precedent for, I think I mentioned it last week, is possibly, and I stress possibly, the old practice of sitting Shiva after an intermarriage. Usually that's traced to Rabbeinu Tam and the period of the authors of the Tosos in the 12th, 13th centuries. However, it looks like, really, Ezra is setting the precedent here with what he does. So the question, though, that remains for us, if you take a look again at Perek Yud Pasuk Dalet, chapter 10, sentence 4, actually earlier than that, Pasuk Gimel, sentence 3, V'atan ichros bris le'elokeinu. This is Shechaniah ben Yechiel's suggestion. Let us make a covenant with our God, lehotzi chol nashim, to remove all women, vanolad mehem, and those who are born from them, batas Hashem, at the council of God. So this reflects the idea, it seems, that the non-Jewish women are the ones who transfer their identity to the children. The children born from them are not Jewish, and the separation is only done, if you go based on that pasuk, based on that verse, from the women. Not from men who are married. If Jewish women marry non-Jewish men, they don't seem to, at least based on this, they don't seem to be separated, and their kids seem to stay with us. So why is it that only the non-Jewish women would be separated and not the non-Jewish men? Yeah?
I have a question first. Where do we see explicitly that the women also intermarried?
Right.
Women might have. There was a warning, don't do it, but it doesn't say that they did.
Right. So one approach to this, and this is the position that we actually saw from Abar Benel, that only Jewish males married non-Jewish women, and the opposite did not happen. What about Bathsheba?
Well, I mean, I guess that only in this period. I mean,
what about
Bathsheba was married to a Hittite?
Yeah. You're assuming that Uriah Chiti is a Hittite and not a Jew who lives in that area. And we have all sorts of people in that book who are named based on their geographic region, but it doesn't reflect tribal identity. So you have Iti Hagiti would be another one. Is he a Plishti living in Gath, or is he, you know, there are different ways that you can take all of those. So whether Uri is Jewish or not is interesting, but yeah, this is a completely different period. But this is supported, the idea that there were no marriages the other way is supported by Malachi, the second chapter in Malachi. Abarbanel takes that and he tries to explain why Jewish men would have married non-Jewish women, but not the other way. It's a little bit of a hard view to sustain, though. And the reason why I say it's hard to sustain is not only the practical question, can it really be? We're going to see a whole long list of intermarriages. Can it really be that a whole bunch of Jewish men married non-Jewish women and nothing the other way? That's hard to imagine. But also because we are going to see in chapter 10, sentence 11, and chapter 10, sentence 44, apparent indications that there were Jewish women who had married non-Jewish men. So that's a hard view to take. Julie.
At this point, has it been established that the child is Jewish and only the mother is Jewish?
Right. So the answer is that is another take that is offered. This is the take generally from secular scholars to say that Ezra is actually implementing matrilineal descent here, and that this is the first time in Jewish history. That's their approach. Until now, the children of Jewish husbands and non-Jewish wives would have been considered Jewish. I brought you on the sheet just the three bullet points in source number one from a fellow by the name of Arthur J. Wolak. He's writing in Jewish Bible Quarterly. He argues that the switch made sense now based on the following. Number one, he said maternal influence on the children. Ezra is concerned about the future of the Jewish people. He knows that the mother is going to be the one, realistically, in that socioeconomic environment, who's going to be spending a lot more time with the kids. And therefore, he wants to make sure the mother is going to be Jewish so as to influence the child. That's one. Second, because this, according to Wolak, would put pressure on the husbands not to marry them, because they would know that their children are not going to take their place in the Jewish community.
But that's so, retroactive.
What do you mean?
They already married them.
Right, but this would prevent it in the future. If you see that your children don't count as yours and don't have a communal role, then you're apt to say, you know what, this is a bad move for me. And so that's a second rationale for doing it, plus the issue of verifiable lineage. Right? You know who the mother is. You don't necessarily know who the father is. So therefore, if you know the mother is Jewish, then they're Jewish. If you know the mother is not Jewish, then not. That's Wolak's argument.
That's never been a concern.
Right, and that's one of the major weaknesses of this approach, which is to say all of these factors would have been factors for a long time before now. It's not as though Ezra wakes up in the beginning of the Second Temple period and has an epiphany. Wouldn't we be doing this right if we actually declared matrilineal descent? It doesn't make any sense. Number two, it doesn't make sense because of the way it's structured in the text. The text says that people come to Ezra to report a problem, right? The people come to Ezra and say, there is a problem. You're not starting with Ezra imposing something. Clearly, the people were responding to a reality based on a law they knew before this event took place. So it doesn't make sense to think that Ezra is the one who's introducing this. Not to mention, this is the least of the three concerns, but I mentioned it as well. How would you get away with doing that? Meaning, we've been living all along with the idea that these people are Jewish, and now Ezra's just going to reverse everything. The reason I say it's the least of the three concerns is because Ezra had a lot of power, right? He was given by King Artaxerxes basically all the cards. He was given the ability to carry out whatever punishments he wanted. He was given all the money. He could take money out of the local taxes. He was given the Beis HaMikdash. The keys of the temple are handed to him. So if anybody in Jewish history wanted to make a change like this, you know, Ezra's in position to do it. But it's a very hard, it's a hard view to sustain, I think. The traditional Jewish perspective is that matrilineal descent starts at either Har Sinai or Abraham and Sarah. That's the alternative. Now you say to me, Abraham and Sarah? What are you talking about? How could it be Abraham and Sarah? Take a look at source number two. Ramban, Nachmanides. Vayikra 24:10. Does that sound familiar to anyone? Probably not. It's in Vayikra. Generally speaking, anything with Vayikra is not familiar to people. What? Close. Emor. The end of Emor. The very end of Emor, the story of the Mechalel, right? The blasphemer whose parents are? Who are his parents? Well, no, it says, who ben ish mitzri? His father is Egyptian, his mother is Shlomit bat Divri. That's who his parents are. So take a look at what Ramban writes there. Umasha amar b'taras kohanim. When the Medrash, Taras Kohanim is the standard halachic Medrash to the book of Vayikra, when the Medrash says, Besoch b'nei Yisrael, in the midst of the children of Israel, that's where he was, Melamed shenis gayer, that teaches he was mit gayer, that teaches he converted. So here you have a case of somebody whose mother is Jewish, whose father is not Jewish, and the Medrash says he converted to Judaism. Wait a minute, why did he need conversion? If you are following, and this is after the Torah is given, right? If you believe that matrilineal descent goes back to Sinai, why does this kid need to convert? He's already a Jew. So Ramban writes, Eino sheyitzarech begeiros. It doesn't mean that conversion was needed. Ela kechol Yisrael shenichnesu lebris mila utvila v'artzaz damim b'shas matan Torah. Rather, what it's saying is, he had gone through what everybody went through at Sinai, which is to say, the original conversion ritual. I mentioned last week, the model for conversion is what the Jews did at Har Sinai, is the circumcision that preceded the Korban Pesach, is the bringing of a korban, is the trip to the mikvah, is the declaration of Naseh and Ishma. That's what we do. That's what a conversion ritual looks like. That's what they did at Sinai, and that's all it's saying here, is to say, he went through what the nation did at Sinai, aval niskavnu lomar, and they intended to say, shahalach acharei imo, v'nidbak b'Yisrael, that he followed the path of his mother, as opposed to his father, and clung to Israel. V'zetam b'soch b'nei Yisrael, which is why the pasuk says, that's why the text says, says, in the midst of the children of Israel, he was with the Jews, and he didn't follow his father to be Egyptian. That's Ramban's explanation. But then he speaks of another school, the French school. And they say no. The French say, that's think Rashi and those of his grandchildren who stayed in France, as opposed to the ones who went to Germany. But Vatsarfatim Omrim, Kitam hagerus mipnei shehaya kodem matan Torah. No, the conversion was necessary. It preceded the giving of the Torah, because this event, the blasphemy, took place after the Torah was given. But he's born in Egypt. And therefore the conversion was before the Torah was given. So he writes, V'haya mishpato lelech achar hazachar. And in fact, at that point, it was patrilineal. That's the position of the French school Ramban quotes, that it's patrilineal at that stage, mimasha amru, based on the Gemara, which said, ba'umos halachachar hazachar, that in general, identity among the nations is you follow the male. So it's patrilineal descent in general, and that includes when you're dealing with the Jews before the Torah was given. The Kasher Nolad Zeh, and when this kid was born, Lo Maluo, so they didn't give him a bris. Ki Mitzvi Haya Bedino, he was an Egyptian. His father's Egyptian, he's Egyptian. Ava Kasher Gadal, but when he grew up, Nis Gayer Ledato Vini Mol, he converted willingly and he underwent a bris. That's the view of the French scholars. And Ramban, sorry. So I don't recall seeing this in Rashi. I didn't hunt to see which of the French school he's referring to. It's a good question. I don't know. But he says, Ve'ein da tikach. He says, I don't agree. Ki mi'eis shaba Avraham bebris, hayu Yisrael uva goyim lo yischashavu. He says, lo yischashavu. He says, I don't agree. From the time that Avram enters the covenant, we are no longer among the nations. He's borrowing the pasuk from Bilam, Bagoyim lo yischashav. Ukmo sh'amru be'esav, v'dilma Yisrael mumer sh'ani. As in fact, the Gemara says regarding Esav, that he had the status of a Yisrael mumer, a Jew who had rebelled. So, in other words, the view of Ramban is that it was matrilineal descent going all the way back to the time of Abraham and Sarah.
There's so many ways to poke holes in them. Just from
go ahead.
I mean, everything from our patriarchs taking other women, whether it be Yitzchak, Yaakov, okay, and then and their sons, Yosef, and Moshe, okay. But in addition, we even have these people coming out of Egypt being told who they can't take, being Moab and Amor. But it doesn't say you can't take the other women. Right.
No, that doesn't say anything about taking them. The passage with Edom and all that isn't about marrying them. It is about marrying them, but what it's saying is even if they convert, you can't marry them. Yeah, or the mystery of the third generation. But going back to your first point, I think what you're pointing out is actually a great debate found in the Medrash. Meaning, you remember the Medrash that says that when Yaakov and his wives have their sons, there are also girls born with them, and that the tribes marry them? That's what they're debating. They're debating that question of, could it be that they married non-Jewish women, and yet their kids were considered part of the Jewish people? That's what's spurring this, is this question of when does it begin? In terms of Beria's question, I think you were about to ask where this source with Esav says anything, because it's viewing his children as Jewish. The idea is that Esav marries these women who are, you know, from Yishmael or wherever, and that the descendants are considered Jewish. I think that's what it's doing, yeah.
But, I mean, not to belabor the point, I would be more comfortable personally saying that midrash, that they were girls born at the same time, and just being as a lesson for all of us. I mean, do you really believe that? I mean, other than maybe it's
You have to remember what the goal of Medrash is. The goal of Medrash is not to be consistent with other elements of the story. It's just to explain a pasuk. I have a problem with a pasuk, and here is the way that you can read that. But it's not it's not trying to conform with other pesukim and other ideas and other midrashim.
Or to be correct.
It's not the goal. But in terms of what's going on here, in terms of what Ramban is saying, and the reason I'm bringing it is to show that you have a classic debate: is it going back to Aharon and Sarah, or is it starting at Sinai? And how do I deal with this medrash about conversion for the blasphemer in that particular story? But the relevance for us is that when Wolak says matrilineal descent begins with Ezra, the response of Jewish tradition is, no, we were doing this for a long time beforehand. Julie.
Yeah, but if you say, well, matrilineal descent has existed since Abraham and Sarah, but, you know, Yitzchak married someone else who was not Israelite, and then...
But that was what we were just...
Yeah.
Well, she's like, yeah. Well, I know, but it's a good point. It's like, oh, it's matrilineal, but... No, it
keep in mind that even saying matrilineal descent does not mean that intermarriage is prohibited. Those are two different things.
Yeah, but they had a whole big thing with Dina and Sophia converting Shechem.
They were never converting Shechem.
Okay, all right. So
that was not a problem.
Yes, right. Okay, but the thing is that Dina would have had to have her husband converted. Period, or Tina couldn't have married. Now, they weren't really planning to.
Is that true? But is that true?
Well, that's what I'm asking you. And I'm also asking you, is if the men in her family didn't marry their sisters, which, frankly, I find pretty horrible thought.
Women half sisters. Half sisters. The answer to your question is that no one requires conversion.
At that point, paternal descent is a big deal, because if Dina marries Shechem and goes off with him, then her children are going to be following Shechem, which is maybe also what they were freaking out over.
Keep in mind, no one in this story, other than Hamor and his father, think that Dina is going to end up with him. Dina doesn't want to. He's very, the red tent notwithstanding, if you read the Chumash, right, Dina was raped. She has no desire to be with this guy, and her brothers have no intent to leave her there. What Yaakov was intending is a really good question. But the point is that this is not... I don't want to conflate the two issues. The issue of whether you can marry someone who isn't Jewish is separate from the issue of, will the children be Jewish? Ralph, and then I want to move on within this, because there's a lot more to say. Yeah.
Well, I'm assuming that Ezra is compensating for the abandonment of this community over the years and that they had assimilated. In Babylon, they would not have intermarried.
We don't know.
So readily. But the ones who were left behind...
Oh, these aren't people who were left behind. These are people who were in Babylon and then came back.
But that's not what it suggests. Just that,
where do you see that?
It's just there are people there who were there before.
It's an interesting idea, but I don't think... Go back to the original verses that describe what was done in Pasuk Aleph in sentence 1, chapter 9, sentence 1, and then sentence 2. I'd have a hard time sustaining the idea that these were people who had never left Israel in the first place. I think you could if you had to, but I wouldn't assume that it was the people who had been left behind.
Whatever you're doing, it's an assumption.
You're talking about...
Yes.
Because it could be read away.
Yes and no. The major problem with it is just that we don't know anything about a community that was left behind. In other words, when this group comes in, the group permitted by Koresh, by Cyrus, they come in as though there's nobody there. This is tabula rasa. We are beginning a new community, and they don't even mention anybody who had been there all along. So I don't see why they would suddenly get thrown in chapter 9. That's my basis for saying that. But no, I can't prove that. I can't prove that. I had said I was going to go forward with it. Sorry. I apologize, but there's so much more to see here. Sorry?
They've only been in Babylon 70 years.
Yes.
It's not long enough to completely...
I think you're making an assumption that I don't think you can make, which is that this would have been the nadir for them and the absolute depth, you know, to which they would not sink in just 70 years. But if you're taking the view, we've been exiled, we've been cast out, and that's it, you know, God's abandoned us.
Why would they want to come back if they were intermarried?
Because Cyrus, king of Persia, said, you can go and you can get wealth and you can settle in this land. That's a potential. But you're right, this is difficult one way or the other. I'm really gonna stick with what we have. There's so much more to say on this issue of matrilineal descent before we can get anywhere. So right now we have one suggestion, which is the only reason why the emphasis is on the non-Jewish women as opposed to the non-Jewish husbands is because that's all that existed. That was Abarbanel's approach. You have a second view that says Ezra is introducing the doctrine of matrilineal descent, which again I think has all of the flaws that we've already talked about. Both views that we've just mentioned have flaws. I note as well source number 3, which is the last one that I want to note on this point of when matrilineal descent is introduced. And this is the Gemara in Kiddushin. But before you see this Gemara, like I noted on your sheet, you have to see Devarim chapter 7, sentences 3 and 4, because otherwise this won't make any sense. Even with it, it will be hard. But without it, you're stuck. So if you flip back to... page 445. It's the passage that I noted on your sheet at number 3. Page 445. This is when we are told in the Chumash about not marrying among the seven nations. Okay? Velo sishatein bam, you shall not marry among them. Bitchalo sitein livno, don't give your daughter to his son. Okay, your daughter should not marry the non-Jewish male. Uvitolo sikach livnecha, and don't take his daughter for your son. Okay, so both ways. Ki yasir es bincha me'acharai, because he will lead your son away from after me. And v'avdu Elohim acherim, they'll worship other gods and so on. What weird thing happened between sentence 3 and sentence 4? God is the speaker.
Only the sons.
Don't take his daughter.
Well, that's true, and it doesn't say bitcha. Right?
Right, but even when it's
right? He will lead your son from after me. It didn't say anything about the daughter. And it says he will lead your son away from me. That's the question. That's exactly where we're going. So take a look now at source number 3, which is the Gemara on it. Ki yasiras bin chame acharai, for he, as I underlined the word, right? For he will lead your son away from me. Bincha haba miyisraelis karui bincha. Your son from a Jewish woman, and if I added in brackets, a non-Jewish husband, right, is called your son. And therefore what it's saying is, he, the non-Jewish father, is going to lead your grandson, really. Remember, though, that in Chumash we regularly conflate generations. So the non-Jewish father is going to lead your grandson away from God. V'ein bincha haba min ha'ovedes kochavim, karoy bincha ela bina. But your son, born from a non-Jewish woman and a Jewish man, was never your son in the first place. That's her son. So the Gemara picks up on the fact that the verse drops bitcha and says yasir, he will lead astray, in order to conclude matrilineal descent. So according to this Gemara, matrilineal descent is in force at the time when the Jews stand on the brink of entering the land of Israel in Parshas Vayeschanan. That's the traditional perspective on where it is, as opposed to the approach that Wolak suggested. So we have two approaches right now. One approach is there were no intermarriages going the other way, only with the non-Jewish women. And again, we noted the flaw in that, which is that there are texts which we're going to see that sound like there are both ways. Second answer is, Ezra's making a big deal of introducing matrilineal descent at this point, which has weaknesses because it doesn't seem like it. It seems like it's already existed. The third approach is to suggest that actually, no, Ezra ordered it both ways. Even though he only mentioned the mothers here, hang on. I'm doing it for Julie also, it's not just you. The third approach is to say, Ezra did say it both ways. Go back to chapter 9, sentence 12. Flip back to page 1835. Ezra did decree it both ways. Granted that when it came to the separation, he only mentioned one. But in terms of the of his decree, he said, "V'atah b'noseichem al titnu livneihem, u'v'noseichem al tisu livneihem."
But isn't he just quoting the pasuk?
Like, oh yeah.
As opposed to saying you did that, he's just quoting it in full.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. But I think that he's giving them a warning about both ways, and he's going to say in chapter 10, sentence 11, bottom of the same page. He says, you have to acknowledge what you've done. Do as God wishes. Separate from the peoples of the land and the foreign women. Now, you could say peoples of the land is generic. Separate from the peoples of the land. But the commentators tend to assume that if the latter part of the sentence is the foreign women, then amei haaretz would refer to the men. And Ezra is, in fact, making the decree in both directions. And the weakness with this answer is, then why do you have the specific mention of wives in the beginning of chapter 10? So each answer we're going to give has a weakness. That's just reality. Yeah.
And you wouldn't say people of foreign lands being women, people that came from outside, people of the land being non-Jews from...
No, because it says nations of the land. It doesn't say foreign...
No,
It says Amei Haaretz.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. We foreign nations of this land, effectively. They foreign in the sense that they're not us. The last approach is that simply it's impossible to tell anything from here regarding matrilineal descent and patrilineal descent. You're out of luck. And Shaya Cohn makes this point. In his The Beginnings of Jewishness, much of this book I do not agree with. This is not an endorsement of the book. But if you take a look at source number 4, he writes, Ezra's jurisdiction extended only to the members of his people, and he could do nothing to a foreign man who had married an Israelite woman. You want to know why Ezra talks about separating from the non-Jewish women and not separating from the non-Jewish men? The answer is that the Jewish women who had married non-Jewish men weren't living among the Jews. Generally speaking, you went with your husband. That was the way it was. And so they weren't living among the Jews. They were living among the fill-in-the-blank, whatever nation they had come from. And so, you know, forget trying to draw any conclusions based on the language here. Follow? So we have 4 different approaches. I have to admit that Shai Cohen's approach has a logic to it. and it makes the whole thing a lot simpler. And that could give you back your last half hour. But I think all of these points are important to be cognizant of. But what he says has a definite logic to it. All right, Elisheva and then Julie, and then we're going to go further.
Just wondering, I think you were talking about how this happened at the same time as Ahasuerus. So could it be like just a political reason? Because if Ahasuerus married Esther, and if he and Dariavish is perhaps the descendant, it would be politically unwise for him to now say, you know, if a, you know, somebody who's foreign, you're an Israelite woman now, because now he's kind of disputing Dariavish's, you know, legitimacy to sort of say anything. So I'm just wondering, could it be a political reason?
That's very interesting. So, I mean, this is technically a little bit later. There's always a difficulty of matching up the Purim story with any of these events, and you know we went around and around on that, you know, last year, as I know you remember. So I'm not sure about that, but it's an interesting idea that you would have had a problem publishing something saying Jewish women married to non-Jewish men have to separate from them in the event that, even if it's not contemporary, it's the preceding generation. It's a very interesting point. The Ahasuerus problem. Yes, Julie.
Okay, so let's play devil's advocate here because I know it's your thing. So Ezra is upset, but he's also setting up reestablishing lineages. Why does he not say, okay, they intermarry, please don't intermarry, just from this point forbidden that these people either, okay, we'll count them, or you know what, just strike them off the list?
I mean, that is what he's going to end up saying. He is going to end up saying, strike them off the list.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
he will do that.
So he's upset mostly. What is making him upset is how could people do this to themselves? Is how there are.
So it's,
or is it now I have more bureaucratics? It's not now I have more paperwork to do.
No, he's upset because, as I go back to chapter 9, he's upset because he's heartbroken that all these people who have come back to build the temple have betrayed the Jewish people by going after the Canaanite tribes. And again, I don't mean to be harsh regarding this issue. I know, as I said, when we started this topic at the beginning of chapter 9, it's very rare to find a Jewish family in which this doesn't exist at this point, and I'm not making statements regarding that. But that's the way Ezra will look at it, you know, is that they've let down the Jewish people as a whole.
Do we have any idea how much time has elapsed since they came back and Ezra made this?
Yes,
ruling?
Yes. You have a few decades.
2 decades?
At least 2, maybe more. Yeah. From the time that Ezra came back, you have 4 months. But there's a long time after they initially came back before we got to Ezra chapter 7.
So that justifies them marrying in the community.
Just, I don't know the word justifies is what I would use, but that may explain what had happened.
Time.
But again, it could have even been from Ezra's own group. We talked about this last year. It could have been Ezra's own group even. Okay, so let's see what happens. Now that we've talked around and around the issue, let's see how things go from here. Chapter 10, sentences 5 and 6 are what we are up to. Page 1835. The goal is not clarity. I should put that on a sign.
Mine.
I said the goal is not clarity. He asked if it was all clear now. I said the goal is not clarity.
The goal is
knowledge. Okay.
Right.
Sentence 5. Vayakam Ezra vayashva es sareya kohanim halviim v'chol Yisrael la'asos kadavar hazeh vayishaveyu. Remember, Ezra was not the one who said they should separate. Ezra was the one who was sitting on the ground crying.
Right.
Shechaniah ben Yechiel is the one who stands up, Pinchas style, and says, we're going to separate the men from the women. That's the one who actually makes the statement, and they say to Ezra, back in sentence 4, get up, because Ezra, this is your responsibility, go ahead and do it. That's the way that it went in sentence 4. Ezra was charged with it, and so that's what he did. He got up, and he declared an oath upon specifically the officers. Sarei, the officers of the Kohanim, the Levim, and all Israel, that they were going to carry this out. Vayishaveyu, and they swore. And then Pasuk Vav, sentence 6, Vayakam Ezra milifnei beis ha'elokim. Ezra got up from in front of the house of God, because that's where he was, by the temple, the Beis HaMikdash. Vayelech el lishkas Yehochanan ben Eliashiv. And he went to the house of Yehochanan ben Eliashiv, a name we have not seen yet, but we will. Vayelech sham, he went there. Lechem lo achal umayim lo shasa. He is still fasting. He doesn't eat bread, he doesn't drink water, he is sustaining the fast. Kimisabel al mal hagola, because he is still grieving for the trespass. Remember that word me'ila was a word that Ezra introduced here. He believes that this is a betrayal of that which is sacred. And that's the word, that's what me'ila means. Abuse of property of the temple, of the Beis HaMikdash, is called me'ila. He is upset about this trespassing by, and here's your answer, Ralph, the gola. Mal ha-gola, the exiles. So that means that the intermarriages were not from people who had remained behind in Israel. These are the people who had been in exile. So, okay, now we have a definitive answer.
How long has he been fasting at this point?
We don't know. No, in all honesty, we don't know. I saw one commentary here who wanted to say that he's fasting even though the fast was over, and that's what the text is trying to point out, but I don't see a basis for saying so. For all we know, this is all the same day, the same afternoon.
No, but just as he isn't drinking water or eating bread.
Yes.
He could be eating fruit and drinking wine.
No. No. You also have to keep in mind something that will serve you well in general in Tanakh, which is that the word lechem often does not mean bread. The word lechem in Tanakh often means food. Okay. So, having said that, the first interesting point here, who is speaking in sentence 5?
The narrator.
Who is?
Ezra.
Ezra, right? It's Ezra who is the one who is speaking about what is what is going on. I'm sorry.
It's like those kids who can't say I.
No, but Ezra is the one who is speaking, and the point is that no, there was something else here that I wanted to pick up on. Hang on. All right, I'm going to remember. There was a specific point that I was trying to make with the use of the third person, but I don't remember now what it is. Okay, fine. I'll come back to that. But Ezra wants to get everybody on board, and he turns to the Sarim. He turns to the officers. Why does he want the officers to be the ones to swear? So I would have assumed the reason is what Ellen says. Because when we go back to the beginning of the story in chapter 9, the officers were the ones who had intermarried in the first place. So he wants to get them on board. And that's one approach. The other approach is a very interesting one that comes from the Malbim. And I brought it for you here on your sheet in source number 5. Ezra lo haya lo koach la ha'anish rak al din Torah. He says, Ezra's power to punish is only in that which is consistent with the laws of the Torah, right? Going back to the power he was given by Artaxasta. Artaxasta said, you can punish people in accordance with the laws of the Torah, even capital punishment, but always in accordance with the laws of the Torah. That's what you get to do. But Ezra wants to intimidate them with harsher penalties, meaning the penalty for these people who intermarry, right, in terms of a human court, separate them from their wives and move on. There may be lashes, there may not be lashes, but that's basically it. What Ezra is going to do here is to decree that anybody who does this and anybody who does not separate is going to lose all their property and be excommunicated. you could make an argument. You could make an argument that this could be licensed, but it's a hard argument to make, and therefore Ezra lacks the ability to carry this out.
Were there other people, like people Cyrus, who were there to carry out his laws?
Or was yeah, Cyrus has a whole network. This is the Persian Empire.
So, Cyrus, so in other words, if it's a Judaic concern, it was Ezra's. If it was...
Ezra has been given the authority to enforce Jewish law in that area. There are people, there are agents of Cyrus in the area. I wasn't sure what you were asking.
Okay. They are enforcing Cyrus's laws. That may be conflicting.
The governing law for this population is going to be the law of Judaism.
So, but why does it say only the law of Judaism? Was like so where there were no Syrian like Cyrus law? Like they were,
that's correct. That's suspended. He has given Ezra full authority. But it doesn't matter here. Because what Ezra's trying to do would not have appeared in Persian law anyway. So even if you had agents of Cyrus who were going to carry out some separate body of law, it wasn't going to include excommunicating and taking away the property of the people who had intermarried.
And Ezra had to base his Jewish law
on what was a precedent? He can only carry out Torah.
Say, okay, this is really what
that's
it
right. That's exactly what Malvin is trying to tell you here.
It is
after the evening. Right, but apparently he's still fasting as he goes on. But you're right, that would be the source for saying that the fast officially should have ended, and he is now in overtime. That's right. Rabbeinu Tam. Okay. But thank you. That's the basis then for saying that it should have been over. Unless you say I rose in my fast, I suppose. So Ezra wants to threaten them with punishments that he doesn't think he's licensed to carry out. So what does he do? There was power for the community. If they would swear that they were going to follow these rules. Because the community has the authority of a king. They can create for themselves whatever penalties they wish. We're going to come back to this. We're not quite there yet. But that's what Malbim is arguing. And therefore, that's why he wants them all to enter into a covenant. To say they're all with him, they're all with Ezra, then they're going to enter this deal. They're going to swear to it. And then they will be able to punish them and consistent with the laws of the Torah. And therefore, Ezra has the leaders swear in order to get the representatives of the nation to agree, and now he will have the authority in Jewish law to carry it out. So two different explanations for why he gets the officers to swear. One, what I would have said, and as Ellen said now, is because the officers were the ones who were guilty in the first place, as we discussed way back when. And number two, Malbim's approach, he needs them in order to have the authority to impose this on the community. Now, they all meet, not in Ezra's house, but in the house of Yehochanan ben Eliashiv. So if you look at your sheet, it's source number 6, you'll see I gave you a reference to Nehemiah. It's a quick flip of the pages. Page 1867. Nehemiah 12, 22-23, where we get a list of the families of Levi and the heads of households. So, in sentence 23, well, first of all, Bimei El Yashiv Yoyadan, so on, B'nei Levi Rashi Ha'avos, right, the heads of the families of Levi, right, K'suvim Al-Sever Divrei Yamin, they're all chronicled, V'ad Yimei Yochanan Ben El Yashiv, up to the time of Yochanan Ben El Yashiv. So it is suggested that that he may serve as Kohen Gadol at some point. At the least, Ezra is doing this in the house of one of the Kohanim. So it's a house that is associated with power within the community, possibly even the Kohen Gadol's household. Clear? Okay. So Ezra has a great big meeting at which he has the officers and leaders swear. And then we get to Pasuk Zion, sentence 7, chapter 10, sentence 7, and a national decision, back on page 1835. Vayaviru kol b'Yehuda v'Yerushalayim, l'chol b'nei ha'golali hikavetz Yerushalayim. They sent the word throughout Judea and Jerusalem. Everybody, all the exiles had better gather in Jerusalem. And if you don't show up in 3 days, in accord with the council of the officers, the elders, Yocharam kol rechusho, all his property becomes cherem. Cherem means that it is confiscated, and they translate here, I see in the art scroll, as destroyed, but keep in mind that it might have actually become the property of the Kohanim. You had that possibility as well. The cherem means different things in different contexts. What it does mean is you don't have it anymore. And that person would be separated from the community of the exile.
Cherem.
Forfeited. I like that better than destroyed, because I think it's open to both possibilities. So there's more to see here, but we have to hold on this right now. Ezra is making a declaration that you're going to lose your property and you will be excommunicated, cut off from the community. We have to talk about this in terms of the power that he brings to the table to be able to do this. Julie, you were going to say.
Yeah, how does that work logistically? I mean, there's people all over the place. It's not like there's no email. He can't send a group email to everybody who came in this year and say, you ought to be here in 3 days. It's going to take days to get messages to everybody by horseback, and then they all have to come. How is he supposed to do this in 3 days?
And the answer is, you're talking about a community that is somewhere at this stage, probably between 50 and 60,000 people. They are networked in terms of their families and heads of families and tribal leaders. And he doesn't have to have everybody show up as much as representatives of each clan.
Well, somebody said he said all the people of the exile.
I understand that, but I still think it doesn't mean that literally they're abandoning their households and their animals and
like
fields.
They're not scattered.
Right, they're not scattered far from the center in Yerushalayim.
And if they were, where would they all meet? It's a lot of people.
And the answer is the house of Yochanan Ben Eliashib.
How big is his house?
Nonetheless, that's what they're doing. Okay, I'm going to skip the practical question of the of how they did it, because they did it. And I'd rather ask the question of Ezra's authority to do this. So we already saw Malbim's position. Malbim's position is that Ezra doesn't have... Sorry?
No, we're just saying that only women think about this. As a guy, the rabbis sit around, they don't think about what teachers say.
You got it.
We're going to meet and how are they getting together. She's getting very...
This is horribly sexist.
It's true, though.
So Malvin's position is, speaking on behalf of myself and Ralph, you know, we're a few of us here. You should be careful. We're a vocal minority. So, in terms of the authority that Ezra brings to bear, Malbim believes it's a function of the community having assigned him this power. And so you take a look at the top of the next slide, source number 7, where Malbim makes the point here, Yocharam kol rechusho, all of his property will be cherem, zebet tokef mashanasa min haklal, tanir le'el gimel. He says, this is by force of what had been done by the community, as was seen in sentence 3. Valze omar ka'atsas hasarim vazkenim, so that it's said by the council of the officers and the elders, Shaklal Yeshlem Kawach Lazek, because the community has the power to do this. That's the position of Malbim, and he's consistent down through the chapter. However, there is another view which is fascinating in its own right and deserves a couple of minutes discussion. It appears several different times in the Gemara, and it's the concept of Hefker Beit Din. Or as the Gemara puts it, Hefker Beit Din Hefker. And what it means is, the Beit Din, and we have to define Beit Din a little bit better, we'll say rabbinical court for the moment, has the power to confiscate people's property. To say, you think you own that, you do not actually own it. Take a look at source number 8. The Gemara in Gittin brings this up in the context of the law of Prosbul. The law of Prosbul being a law in which loans which should have been nullified during Shemitah are actually not nullified during Shemitah. The mechanism of Prosbul is way beyond the scope of what we're going to discuss right now. But the point is that what licenses the court to be able to say the loan is going to survive Shemitah? And the answer is because they have absolute power over your property anyway. They can say, this, you thought this belonged to you, it actually belongs to so-and-so. So take a look at source number 8. The Gemara there, in discussing this, asks, Minayin Shehefker based in Haya Hefker. Where did you get that idea from? That a court can just do that. So they quote our Pasuk in Ezra, Shenemar. They quote our sentence. V'chol asher lo yavo l'shlesh le'amim, anyone who doesn't show up, right, within 3 days. And it says specifically, Ka'atzas hasarim v'azkenim. Right? According to the council of, as planned by the officers and the elders, he's going to lose all his property. That's one source. The other source is Rabbi Eliezer brings it from Yehoshua, where we're told that Elazar, Yehoshua, and the heads of the tribes allot property in Israel. They give out the portions. Until then, it's just a tribal portion. They decide, you're getting this land, and you're getting this land, and they give out the land to each one. V'chima inyan rashim etzalavos. Why do the texts mention heads along with fathers? To teach you that just like the father allots the inheritance to his children, so too the heads allot to the nation as they choose. Without getting into inheritance and how that works, because that's beyond the scope here, the Gemara reads the power of the Beit Din, the power of the religious court, and the power to assign property to particular parties. I want to make sure to get through this point before 2:30. So this has a long-term impact on the Jewish world. This became a basic principle in Jewish law. I brought you a few sources here. Source number 9, the Rambam says, a judge in a Beit Din can always remove ownership of property. He can always be mafkir mamon, sheyesh lo bailim. He can always remove property, transfer it, whatever it is, and he quotes you the verse from Ezra. That's one example. That's a judge in a court giving a ruling at the moment. Stronger than that, the Rashba, Rabbi Shlomo ibn Aderet, in source number 10, deals with a particular case. A community made a rule. There were people who were getting married without a minyan. Normally we require a minyan for a wedding to be valid, not just witnesses, but we require a minyan for Sheva Brachot, for the 7 blessings that are said under the chuppah. So a community was faced with a problem in which people were engaged in kiddushin. They were performing this act of kiddushin without a minyan present. And the question that was put to the Rashba was, does the community have the ability to declare that marriage invalid? If they do the kiddushin, nisuin, the full stage of marriage, requires a minyan. Kiddushin technically does not. So can the community say, we declare that if anybody does this without a minyan, it's invalid? That would be a very good thing to do. Right? If you remember the case about 10 years ago, the Kiddushei Ketana case, there was a custody battle in which the man, knowing that he wasn't going to get custody of his minor daughter, said to the court, I accepted Kiddushin for her from somebody. I accepted it and no one else knew about it. Said, I'm not going to tell you who it is in order to be able to hold his wife and his daughter hostage in order to be able to get what he wanted out of the divorce proceeding. But if you follow what they wanted to institute here in this community, then you have a problem, because you have the ability to say proactively, we will disqualify such things in advance. We're telling you now they won't be valid. And the Rashba said, you can do that. Take a look at source number 10. He says, Shuras Hadin, by letter of the law, nearly Bevemur, it appears clear to me, Sharashan, B'nei Ha'ir La'asaskein. Community can do that. Ubelvash, Yiskimu B'kachan Shei Ha'ir, so long as the population agrees to it. And no, that does not mean every last individual in the city. V'im Yesham Tamar Chacham B'lo, Hiskimi Mahim Lo. If there is a scholar there who doesn't agree with whatever rule they want to make, then no, he has to go along with it. Where does the power come from? He goes on to quote our idea of Hefker Beit Din. The idea is not just Hefker of a rabbinical court, but Hefker declared by the community. The community is entitled to declare, you think you own that, you don't actually own it. And one more source on this, source number 11, Rabbi Avram Kahana Shapiro, also known as the Kavna Rav, said that the logic behind this is the same logic regarding government. Meaning, the government is able, within a Jewish community, is able to say, we are going to confiscate property, we are going to transfer property, we're going to make rules about how you engage in transactions. It's the same Hefker based in solution. So in other words, what happens is, or that's the mechanism, I should say, what we end up saying is, effectively, we come back to Malbim's point. Malbim said that Ezra needs to gather everybody, to gather the officers, in order to empower him to issue this rule. I pointed out that the Gemara says that Ezra, any Beit Din, any rabbinical court, has this authority anyway. But what we're seeing here in the Rambam and more in the Rashba, and in source number 11 from the Kavna Rav, the Devar Avram, in source number 11, is that actually this is the this power that a rabbinical court has fundamentally comes from the power of the community. The community vests this power in the rabbinical court, and that's where Ezra is actually getting this. Last note, and I'll take questions for the last couple of minutes. I brought it for you in source number 12, but we don't have time to read it inside. I just wanted to show you there, Rav Natronoi Gaon used this idea from Ezra in source number 12, excommunication. His case was that there were people who were using a Haggadah in which they quoted verses in Magid, but they didn't quote the Midrashim that expand on those verses. And he believed that they were Karaitic. Others argue that it wasn't Karaitic. That was actually the standard Israeli Haggadah of the time. But keep in mind, Rav Natronoi Gaon, you're talking 9th century. That's when the Karaites are at their height. And he believes it's Karaite Haggadah. He says, anybody who does this, Yibadel Mikahal Hagolah. He will be separated from the community. In other words, this excommunication method that Ezra declares goes on to be invoked and used down through the centuries. That's what we're talking about. Okay. There are a lot of questions here. Ralph, Susan, Julie. Yeah.
I just wanted to ask if the rulings of the authorities here can be challenged. There's another level.
So in the event that somebody believes that there was an error, it can be called to their attention. Theoretically, a greater authority can argue with them, can dispute with them.
So there's a superior court as well.
Well, superior court is not defined by the clean and simple structure that exists in North America today. Your court has to... You would deal with two different issues. Number one, anybody can challenge whether they're greater or not. If they have a source that they believe shows that they're wrong, that's it. Separate from that, a court that is greater, meaning it has more followers and greater wisdom, is able to repeal an earlier decree. That's a separate thing. That's not really a challenge as much as it is a repealing. There's more to say on this, but it's a larger discussion. Potentially. They certainly have the authority to do it. Yeah. Susan.
Well, when you were talking about this, I know we have found land. Today it's done. We were told they thought there was nickel on the land, and they said, goodbye.
They thought there was?
Nickel.
Nickel, yeah.
Down in the minerals. And it's government land.
Eminent domain.
That's their domain. And also people have their houses they want to build. They say, okay, you
correct.
It's sort of like,
yes.
On this.
Yes. Yes. The power of eminent domain is biblical. That's the short answer. Correct. Jolie, you were going to say? No? Keitha?
No, this is a little fancy.
This is the last question I'll take, and then people can stay and discuss after. Yeah.
You've introduced a concept that I'm certainly not familiar with, that the community can decide on something.
Yeah.
And back it. And they have the last word on it.
Yep.
How could you use this today in places of Agunda? Or where the community decides we're not accepted.
Right. So the authority of the community, the authority of community exists for interpersonal issues, does not exist to change a law found in the Torah. So the Rashba's example is the perfect example. The community is not able to say Kiddushin done without a minyan doesn't work. Kiddushin requires, they can't implement a rule saying Kiddushin requires a minyan. It doesn't. Nisuin does, Kiddushin does not. However, what they are able to do is to say the property you think you own with which you did the Kiddushin actually isn't yours. And thereby, sorry? No. To do Kiddushin means you require a ring, whatever it is. You don't own the ring.
So therefore?
And therefore the Kiddushin is invalid. So there are ways in which it can prevent problems, but it requires, in this case, it requires thinking in advance to make the rule. You can't go in retroactively and say you never owned that historically. That time travel is beyond the scope of the community's rights. You have to go beforehand, think ahead, and write the rule properly.
So if you knew the ring the fellow was going to present was not really his...
Well, if it's not really his, then there's no discussion. What you want to do is confiscate it. What you want to do is say, it isn't yours. And he says, I bought it. And you say, yeah, I know, but the community is taking it away from you. There's more to say. God willing, we continue next week. I'll stick around for a little bit to discuss. Thank you.